Welcome to a very special edition of Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Caroline Seymour. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. Today, we had the pleasure of speaking with Mudit Chaudhary, MD, to discuss the risk COVID-19 poses to patients with cancer, recommendations regarding the use of personal protective equipment, the steps that are being taken to ensure the delivery of optimal care, and the rise of telehealth as a means of patient and physician interaction. In our exclusive interview, Dr. Chaudhary, a chief resident physician of radiation oncology at Rush University Medical Center, shared advice for family members living with patients with cancer, projected the long-term implications of the COVID-19 pandemic on clinical practice, provided insight on the effects of investigational treatments for patients with COVID-19, and detailed the protocols Rush University Medical Center has put into place to limit the spread of the virus. Thank you so much for joining me, Dr. Chaudhary. My first question for you, there's obviously a lot of misinformation regarding COVID-19. So what do we currently know about the risk of the virus to cancer patients?
That's a great question. At the moment, we're still learning a lot. So things could change in the future. But right now, we are finding that cancer patients tend to have a slightly increased risk of both contracting COVID as well as having some more severe side effects or symptoms from COVID. There's probably lots of reasons for this, but I think the main ones include that cancer patients are frequently immunocompromised in the sense that cancer itself causes the immune system to be a little bit weaker. Some of the treatments that we use in addition to that also can cause the immune system to be weaker. For example, chemotherapy or immunotherapy or radiation therapy can temporarily decrease the immune system while we're trying to actually fight and kill the cancer, which can make them have an increased risk of contracting COVID. Cancer patients generally tend to need to come into the hospital multiple times for treatment, and just the exposure risk of constantly coming into a healthcare setting can lead them to be at higher chances of getting COVID compared to a non-cancer patient. So all that combined kind of is leading to those numbers that I believe we're seeing.
So you're a radiation oncologist. So how have you found that the pandemic has impacted treatment plans for your patients?
You know, the first thing is that we're still open and we're still treating, probably up to 75% of our capacity that we were doing in the past. And that's because radiotherapy is still considered one of the main ways to fight and kill cancer. And that hasn't changed during this time. Some of the things that we've done to decrease the risk for our patients, though, is to have as truncated of a treatment course as possible to be able to safely get rid of the cancer, and also minimize the risk of coming in back and forth into our center.
Cancer care requires a multidisciplinary team. So how have you found that it's impacted adjacent specialties?
Yeah, I think the biggest change has probably been to our surgical colleagues. The reason for that is that, when this uprise in cases was happening, it was like pretty dramatic, and it required a lot of resource allocation away to keep ventilators free, to keep ICUs free, and to actually even create additional ICUs, including in areas like the ORs. And our surgery colleagues, thankfully, they're multi-talented, and they were able to take care of some of these COVID patients in that aspect. So we also lost some providers in that sense. So because of that, a lot of patients were having to have delays in surgery. And that has, down the line, shifted things for other specialties, including radiation oncology as well as medical oncology, because typically a lot of times we come in after the surgery. In certain cases, we've been able to adapt. So, for example, in early stage non-small cell lung cancer, where even though surgery is considered the gold standard at the moment, we have a strong alternative by using stereotactic body radiotherapy. This provides roughly equivalent results as surgery, but can be done completely on an outpatient basis from 1 to 5 treatments. So for those cases, while there was less OR availability or surgeon availability itself, we've been able to compensate and still provide definitive care for these patients. And similarly, our medical oncologists have been able to provide neoadjuvant chemotherapy or hormonal therapy, whatever was needed to treat the cancer at the moment while still buying time for when the ORs were able to be reopened for our surgery colleagues.
Is telehealth being used as the primary means of patient-physician interaction? And what are the challenges that are associated with such an approach?
Yes, we have ramped up telemedicine, I think, nationwide as oncologists. Currently, in our institution, probably 75% of the follow-up and consults are being done via telemedicine. And it's proven to be an amazing tool to help patients to avoid risks of coming in and still being able to give them the opinion that they're seeking. I think the biggest drawback to telemedicine is, you know, it's a little bit harder to provide that empathetic touch from just being close by and being in the room together and being able to really discuss. So it's a little bit slightly less personal, I would say. Another drawback to telemedicine that I find is that it takes a little bit of practice for both the physicians as well as the patients to get comfortable with actually just using the software, as well as like having barriers such as if patients don't have a smartphone to begin with or don't have, you know, strong Wi-Fi network at home. So that can make that a little bit challenging as well. And we are seeing disparities nationwide with that in terms of like urban, rural, and based on education level, as well as based on money level. So we're having to figure out ways to be creative to make sure patients get the appropriate care they deserve.
Now that states are starting to reopen, do you anticipate that telehealth will or telemedicine will continue to be used, or do you anticipate it kind of going by the wayside?
Yes, I think telemedicine is here to stay. And I think for certain reasons, the main one being is unfortunately COVID isn't going away anytime soon. So right now, we still want to be smart with decreasing exposure risk for our patients, continuing social distancing, and telemedicine allows us to continue that at the moment. We also find, like as a big academic referral center in Chicago, we're seeing patients from, you know, hours and hours away from, you know, more rural parts of Illinois or Indiana, even Wisconsin, and it's definitely inconvenient for patients to have to come in for these appointments. So anything we can do to improve their convenience, I think we have to do because cancer is just such a anxiety-provoking and scary time. And if that is something we can do to help them, we should do it.
Absolutely. Now, what are you recommending for your patients when it comes to the use of personal protective equipment? I know there's already a shortage for healthcare providers. So what does that mean for patients?
Yeah, at the moment, we recommend to just use a mask at all times, to use constantly, whether you're coming in to see us or going outside to the grocery store or wherever. I don't necessarily think that an N95 mask at all times is necessary, but if that's something that the patient has, I certainly won't discourage them from using it. And beyond that, I think just washing your hands frequently, trying to limit contact to your face and limit contact to, you know, touching with other, like handshakes with other people, et cetera. Beyond that, I think there's nothing more severe that I would recommend.
Of course, patients are dealing with their own diagnosis, and now they're dealing with the added fear of potentially contracting, COVID. Do you anticipate there being delays or disruptions in care because of that?
Yes, I think, unfortunately, there have already been delays. And nationwide, again, I think with the biggest delay being cancer screening, catching a lot of earlier stage cancers, and those having to unfortunately be pushed off because of the risk of COVID, as well as limited resources during this time. So that is one of our biggest fears as oncologists, is that we're going to have a lot of later stage cancers than we would have expected or hoped for during this time. In terms of once the diagnosis is made, we're still doing our part to make sure that the care is done as quickly but safely as possible, because even during a pandemic, cancer care is a vital and necessary treatment, as well as a priority for us even during this time.
Do you have any advice for family members living with patients with cancer?
Yes, I think, I understand it's scary. I would not say that you need to leave them alone just because you guys are together. I think the emotional and social component of being together outweighs the risk of contracting it to each other. I think I would still recommend just being smart, just like everybody else, and trying to avoid as many interactions as possible, as well as just maintaining hygiene while in the house. But I don't think that you need to separate from your loved ones, because it's the risk, is not so high being together compared to the feelings of loneliness or that it would be if you left.
Sure. Now, what could some of the potential long-term implications of the virus be on practice? You mentioned how telemedicine is probably here to stay. I spoke with someone earlier who was saying that, there's probably going to be a push for a national licensure. What else do you think could result from this?
One of the more encouraging things, there's a lot of discouraging things out there right now, but one of the more encouraging things from this that I've noticed is a lot of data sharing, a lot of collaboration between institutions and even countries to come together to try to find ways to help our patients. Historically, research for patients has been done in the US where there's a big push to be first rather than best. But in this case, I think everybody has banded together to try to find the right answers to be able to deliver the optimal care for our patients. So I would like to see that continue. They're actually presenting on a collaborative effort of cancer patients who had COVID. So that was amazing to see how quickly people got together and were able to gather such a large data set. And I think that, I hope, is that going to stay for the future?
Yeah, definitely. Lots of registries coming to the forefront. Sort of on that note, what do we know about investigational treatments that are being evaluated for COVID-19?
Yes, there's been a lot of news about a lot of different drugs that we've been trying out. Unfortunately, a lot of them have turned out to be negative. I think at the moment, the only positive drug trial that's been reported has been with remdesivir. And so we're continuing to explore and find out more about the optimal use of it, length of treatment, dose of treatment, and does it truly help all different types of COVID patients or only a certain subset. There's been some positive news about convalescent plasma recently. So that was encouraging to see. And then most recently, I've been reading about a trial using low-dose radiotherapy to the entire lung to try to reduce the cytokine storm that occurs during COVID. I don't know much about that or, if it will be successful, but it's certainly provocative, and we'd certainly hope that it does help. And as long as the risks are appropriately taken to keep staff and the patients healthy from it, I hope to see that succeed.
Now, going back a little bit, you mentioned how, there may be, you're trying to, prolong the intervals between treatments. Does that extend to lab work? And if so, are you ordering or are antibody tests being ordering for patients with cancer to kind of keep tabs on their exposure?
Yeah, antibody testing is still very new. It's kind of hard to interpret how that works. At Rush, we are offering antibody testing to both patients as well as to staff. The problem is, even if somebody comes back positive and that it shows that you've been exposed and you've developed some antibodies, there's already been reports of reinfection rates in patients who had COVID and recovered in the past. So at the moment, I don't see this antibody test as a movement passport for our patients, but I hope to continue to learn more and see how it goes.
Is there anything that is being done at Rush that you would like to kind of shine a spotlight on in terms of how you're managing COVID or patients with cancer?
Yes, I've been extremely proud of how proactive Rush has been during this time. Both in communication with patients as well as staff to let everybody know what we're doing and how we have everyone's best interests at heart during this time. I think some of the things that we're doing, you know, happen before the patient even enters here. So when a patient has an appointment, before they even come in, we call them a day in advance and ask them screening questions to see how they're doing, you know, to refer them to COVID drive-through testing if needed, or to come straight to the hospital. Once you get here, we're doing universal masking for everybody, patients and staff. We provide the mask for all the patients. You don't have to bring it in here. We have temperature checks at every single entrance. Once you check in, we again ask you screening questions to see how you're doing each and every time. We've expanded our hours, both on weekdays, as well as started oncology care on weekends, which is usually not seen as frequently throughout the nation. But we've done that in order to provide patients enough distance between each other in terms of appointments, so that way they can come in and get the cancer care that they need, but again, have the risk exposure decrease. Most recently, finally, we're actually also offering COVID testing to every single patient before they come in for radiotherapy, surgery, or systemic therapy. We like to do that as close as possible before their start time. So for us in our department, we're doing it within 72 hours of coming in for radiation therapy. Just to, again, if they come back positive, then we'll discuss at multidisciplinary tumor boards, including infectious disease experts, internal medicine experts, intensivists, in addition to the oncologic team, to see if we should change the treatment plan given the new diagnosis or not.
I was just going to ask, so if a patient does come back COVID positive, is treatment halted altogether, or, you know, what do you do?
I'd say a case-by-case basis. I think some of the guidelines that had come out in the past, like in the initial phases of what we should do, were kind of written with little experience. It was kind of just done in hopes of risk reduction as best as possible. So some of them actually say you should halt completely and don't do anything. We found that, you know, for certain asymptomatic patients, that it's okay to continue with treatment as long as there's a optimal discussion amongst all specialties, as well as talking to the patient themselves and letting them know of the risks in advance and see what they want to do and let them be a part of their own care. And we've been able to successfully, you know, treat radiation therapy in COVID positive patients that were minimally symptomatic when they got tested. Certainly don't recommend it uniformly to do that for every patient, but I think it just shows you that every patient is so different, and, you know, a one-stop rule doesn't necessarily work, and we have to really just look at the patient, their comorbidities, their symptoms, as well as their feelings about how they want to move forward.
Sure. Now, I can't speak for Chicago. I can only speak for New Jersey, where we've been in quarantine for about 6 weeks now. Do you have any advice for patients who are, you know, kind of, they have cabin fever, they would like to get out, but they're worried about, you know, increasing their exposure?
Yeah, I know New Jersey has been hit really bad. I was just reading, it was like over 170,000 cases. Like, it's, wow, it's unbelievable. We have not had it as bad in Chicago, thankfully. I think part of that was the early quarantine that was recommended by the governor. We've similarly been inside now, I think, for about 6 weeks or so. And even myself, like, I've definitely noticed getting cabin fever. For patients, I would recommend the quarantine doesn't necessarily mean you need to be inside 24 hours a day. I think, you know, going outside is good for your mental health, but I think you have to be smart about it. So certain things that I've noticed is I have a young daughter, and going to a nearby park in the mornings, very early mornings, I found there's nobody there. And so I've been able to walk outside. You know, I still keep my mask on just to be safe. I even bought a little baby mask for her, but we keep it on and still get our walking in, get some sunshine in, because it just does improve our mood, like you were saying. I think, you know, we try to still be smart, avoid big crowds. If we see a lot of people are outside, you know, just walk around the block and come back inside. But I just don't think a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week quarantine is just practical for anybody.
Sure. Is there anything else that you wanted to emphasize that I didn't ask?
I just want to emphasize again that, you know, for for our patients, we want you to know we are thinking of you constantly during this time. We are thinking of ways. We understand you're super anxious. You know, cancer is not an easy diagnosis by any means. And we are doing everything we can in our power to make sure that you get the care you need and deserve as quickly and safely as possible while minimizing the risks of COVID to you. And our motto at this time is still like oncology care needs to continue. And that's what we're going to do. And that's what Rush has done an excellent job at so far that I'm very proud of.
Great. Well, I think that's a perfect note to end on. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you having me on.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to Onc Live On Air. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for recaps from our State of the Science summits and exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and OncLive SOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.